Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast from Canberra. I'm Michelle Grattan. We're a little over a week out from the Abbott government's first budget, and the argument about debt and deficit and broken promises is raging even before we see the numbers. Andrew Lee is the Shadow Assistant Treasurer and the member for Fraser in the ACT. One thing we do know about the budget is that Canberra, with all those public servants, will get a hard time. Andrew Lee, your specialty is economics. Trying to be as objective about the situation as you can, how do you see Australia's economy at the moment?
Michelle, I think it's an economy in transition. The mining boom has been the big story of the past decade, and that huge terms of trade shock, really unprecedented for over a century, and the effects that it had on trade-exposed industries, ranging right from manufacturing through to universities. As that shock comes down, the challenge is making sure that we're investing in the industries that'll need to build Australia's prosperity over the coming decades. I see great opportunities in finance, healthcare, in areas like architecture, certainly in education, as a rising middle class in our northern neighbours creates demand for Australian service exports. But we've got to be making those investments in infrastructure and in skills for that to happen.
And how serious do you think the budget situation is? Do we have a major challenge to repair the budget?
Well, if you look across the developed world, we've got a debt load around a tenth of GDP. Many countries have debt loads higher than their annual income. And that for those countries, the challenge is 10 times higher than ours. We have, though, seen just over the period since the coalition was elected a big increase in the budget deficit, which, you know, frankly surprised me. You look from the independent PIFO brought down during the campaign period by the Secretaries of Treasury and Finance and compare that to Joe Hockey's first budget update. The deficit over 4 years grows $68 billion and doubles over that four-year period. So the budget deterioration just in the past 6 months has been pretty astonishing to behold. Some of it sort of economic trickery around the treatment of foreign aid and taking off the spending cap. And some of it is real decisions and the decision not to go ahead with labour measures to prevent profit shifting by multinationals has had a role in deteriorating the budget position.
So is this deterioration due to a change in the economic situation, or has it been driven by the government's own decisions, or what?
Well, there's three things that have gone on. The first is that the government has changed economic parameters. So the Treasury was very clear that that was a government decision rather than a Treasury decision, and that made a difference. The second is decisions not to go ahead with certain tax measures. So there's 55 Labor tax measures that were abandoned by the government last November, December, as Arthur Sinodinos announced. Things like a slightly higher tax rate on people with more than $2 million in their superannuation balances. And the government decided not to proceed with that at a cost of billions to the budget, carbon price, mining tax. And then the third is proceeding with new spending policies, such as parental leave, $50,000 to the most affluent families when they have a child. So those three things together, parameters, not going ahead with tax measures, and adding new spending measures.
Would the parental leave be in the forward estimates yet?
It is part of the net effect that the government has had on the budget. I'm not sure whether it's directly in the costings there. So you're right. That's something that may only hit the budget in months to come, which would then make things worse again. The real question is, if we're in a budget emergency, why would you give $50,000 to millionaire families to have a child? It just doesn't make sense.
If you were framing the budget, when would you want it to be back in surplus?
If you look at the pre-election economic and fiscal outlook, that had us back in surplus in 2016-17, which seemed reasonable. I think the return to surplus was important, and it's important to do that, you know, in a fair way. And so one of the things perhaps we didn't talk about enough in government was the double dividend that came from the carbon price. Not only did you raise revenue from the carbon pricing mechanism, but then also you provided income tax cuts. In some sense, you increased the price of pollution and you reduced the price of working. And the government now is in the position of having to do exactly the reverse of that, because they want to cut the price of pollution. They're going to have to raise the price of working through this income tax levy, which Tony Abbott's now mooting.
Now, it seems that both sides of politics favour means testing when they're in government and criticise it when they're in opposition. Labor imposed some means tests when it was in power. Won't it be hypocritical if it attacks the means testing that this budget will bring in?
I think means testing's really fundamental to the Australian system. Peter Whiteford has some useful stats that we give 12 times as much to the poorest fifth. The typical OECD country only gives twice as much to the poorest fifth. And so, as you say, means tests around the private health insurance rebate, decisions around baby bonus, family tax benefit B were all important. We do, though, need to distinguish that from a situation in which you take away universal health care, because I think there is a sense of all of us being in the same community, sharing in the same services. And I get worried when I hear recommendations that we really ought to split into a two-tier system, one in which the more affluent Australians are actively discouraged from using public hospitals and public schools.
Coming close to home, Labor last year indicated that it would trim public service numbers. Do you think there is any fat in the Canberra Public Service?
No, I don't. We, over our term in office, increased public service numbers modestly year on year, except for our final year in office. But that simply left Australia with about the same number of public servants per person as we had at the end of the Howard era, and about the same number of public servants per person as the typical OECD country has. The Australian public service is well-trained, lean, and I think does a great job of providing frank and fearless advice. And I think Mr. Abbott, from his own purely self-interested perspective, was wrong to get rid of departmental secretaries when he came to office, and is wrong to slash and burn the public service as it has. Canberran public servants are really marked by that ability to provide great advice to the government of the day, even if they voted a different way from the politicians that they're representing. We in government got great advice from public servants who voted Liberal in every election. And I think I'd urge Mr. Abbott to remember that as he's crafting his public service policies.
How do you know they voted Liberal?
Oh, I spent 6 months seconded to Treasury, so I spent plenty of time in Treasury with people who are of all ideological persuasions.
Do they talk about their private politics, the behind the scenes, the Treasury offices?
When you're seconded into a department for 6 months, you get to know people well, and you know, I think that there's actually a great value of being surrounded by people who think and vote differently from you. One of the things I worry about in politics today is we're getting too much into echo chambers where conversations just take place among people of like mind. It's the old Doris Kearns Goodwin characterisation of Lincoln's cabinet, team of rivals. You do really draw much more out of being in a room with people of very, very different views.
Do you think that the public service has become politicised over the years, or perhaps intimidated a bit over the years? Governments.
I don't think there's a long run trend, but I certainly did see the process that took place when John Howard won office, and again when Tony Abbott won office, of picking and choosing departmental secretaries, and as Ken Henry's noted, the decision to remove Martin Parkinson would be unprecedented in the history of the Treasury, more than a century. That, I think, sends a very bad signal to the public service, and the quality of advice provided to the public service is best if it's driven by a sort of team of rivals approach.
Are you getting any whispers about Parkinson's successor?
I haven't heard. No, it's there's certainly plenty of rumours around. I launched a book the other day at Treasury where I speculated on who will be the first woman to head the departments of Treasury or Finance. I'd certainly like to see that happen sooner rather than later.
And who were your picks?
I'm not sure I would advance their chances by naming their names, but I certainly think that we're now in a situation where there is a large group of people who would do a large group of women who would do a capable job heading Treasury or Finance.
Now, we've seen the Commission of Audit report this week, of course, and Labor's trashed most of the ideas in that report. But do you see any good ideas there at all? Could you name a couple of things that would be worth taking up?
I think paring back on parental leave made a lot of sense. I think the Commission took the same approach as the Productivity Commission took when we asked them to whether a wage replacement scheme would be appropriate. The Productivity Commission told the then Labor government, look, it wouldn't do more to boost productivity or participation. I think that's fairly standard economic wisdom, that a system that gives more to those who are more affluent doesn't pay off for the community at large. And it's so inconsistent with the Australian social safety net, which is either flat rate benefits or means-tested benefits.
Now, on your side of politics, a big debate in the Labor Party at the moment is about party reform. Mm. And you're one of a very small handful of people, I think, who's not in a faction. Is that a lonely life? Do you feel like a homeless man?
So there's three of us at the moment in the federal caucus
who aren't
in a faction, Alana McTiernan and Nova Peris. And so I have two extraordinary non-factional colleagues.
The non-factional coffee club.
Look, there are many amazing people in the Labor caucus, but there isn't a sports star like Nova Peris, and there isn't somebody who has that same wealth of experience in local, state and federal Western Australian politics that Alana has. So they're great parliamentarians and good friends.
But it does make it harder to get ahead if you're not in a faction, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's mattering less and less. You see this on a whole range of policy debates recently. I think there is. One of the things that I very much appreciate is the friendships that cross-cut factions, and it's important to point out that these groupings exist in other parties as well. Famously, the Wets and Dries and the Liberal Party have organised around personalities, and I think to organise around ideas is a better way of framing your debates than to be the pro-Abbott and anti-Abbott or the pro-Turnbull and anti-Turnbull forces.
So why did you decide to keep yourself nice?
I don't know. I certainly think it's unfair of you to characterise my factional friends as not being anything other than nice. But for me, while I had great respect for friends in factions, I was comfortable operating outside the factional system. And the ACT has always been less factionalised than elsewhere. So I certainly would not have won pre-selection for the seat of Fraser had I been part of a faction. And for me,
that's a very good reason.
Yeah, it's part of what do they say in politics? Dance with the one that brung you. The sense of
or dance with them all.
But it's the sense of keeping faith with the people who gave me the honour of Labor pre-selection here.
Now, just to go to a couple of reform specifics, one suggestion is that the rank and file of the ALP should directly elect delegates to the national conference. What do you think about that?
I'd certainly be comfortable with direct election of delegates, and I know New South Wales is exploring it. In the ACT, we're probably on the extreme of democratic democracy within the party, full rank and file selection of MPs, senators, and members of the Legislative Assembly, and so that puts us in a very comfortable place for further democratic moves. And in fact, I suspect if the rules in the rest of the Labor Party around Australia operated like the ACT, then we perhaps wouldn't be having this conversation.
And what about Senate pre-selection? Should the Senate candidates be chosen directly by the rank and file, or at least partly chosen by the rank and file?
Yes, I think so. And certainly in the ACT, that's given us a terrific Labor senator in Kate Lundy. And more broadly, I think the principle Labor has always advanced in politics is that we ought to expand the franchise. So there's strong progressive push behind extending the franchise to women, to Indigenous Australians, big push in Labor's last term in office towards making sure that we had as many people as possible on the roll. And what drove that is the idea that decisions made by large groups of people tend to be better than decisions made by small groups of people, and we should apply that same principle to the Labor Party.
Do you think reform should be a priority for the Labor Party, or do you think it's a bit of a distraction from the issues that concern Mr. and Mrs. Average?
I think we can walk and chew gum. I think we can democratise our party while still talking about the big challenges that face Australia. Whether that's the rise in inequality over the past generation, challenges around the strength of community in Australia, one of the things that concerns me, I think we spoke about last time, were the fact that Australian test scores at school have flatlined for a generation, and the fact that our patenting rate is lower than it should be. We can focus on all of those big policy challenges while at the same time making sure that we keep on modernising the Labor Party. And modernising the Labor Party is a continual process. It won't ever come to an end, and we say, well, we've got the perfect Labor Party now. It doesn't need to be touched.
Now, just finally, you always seem to have plenty of time for extracurricular activities. You must get up very early. What are you working on now? Are you writing another book, or is there some other project on the go?
Well, one of the big projects is looking after three wonderfully active little boys.
Whom does get up very early.
One of whom, yes. My 1-year-old Zachary has been getting up a bit before 5 o'clock some mornings. So Gwyneth and I have been taking turns to get up with him. Thanks to the forbearance of my extraordinary staff, I've carved out a little bit of time to write a book on economics, which will be called The Economics of Just About Everything, and that'll be coming out with Alan and Unwin in August.
Thank you very much. That was Shadow Assistant Treasurer Andrew Lee, and that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast today. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. We'll talk again soon.